The Homeland Security Department will debut its Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Dashboard. It is the latest in a series of efforts that the administration is making on continuous diagnostics and mitigation. Rob Roy is Federal Chief Technology Officer at HP Enterprise Security and my guest for Industry Chatter today. And he says that CDM is just this episode is just the latest in a chain of events. Rob, you have been following CDM for a long time. It's great to have you back on the program, by the way. Thanks for being here today. This is an issue that you've been looking at for a long time. We've spoken about it before. How do you look at the evolution of CDM over, let's say, the last 2 or 3 years when it first really became prominent as a strategy, a security strategy in government?
Well, thanks for having me, Francis. I appreciate the opportunity. We obviously, CDM has been a program in the making for several years now. The funding for it and the programmatization of it is coming out this year. The first award happened in February of this year. And I think, you know, the intent behind it, as we've seen, is it's really significant engagement and with a lot of foresight from the federal government, the people running cybersecurity, a lot of really smart people that have that are standardizing the way that the federal government can not only implement the right security controls consistently across federal government, but be able to acquire those in a consistent way. So we are seeing right now. You alluded to the dashboard award this week. That's another part of the evolution of automation. And automation, I think, is really a key in all of this. As we've seen in FISMA reporting over the years, it's been a manual process with lots of checkboxes. And many in the security community have said checkboxes do not imply security. But it is a way that we get there. And the dashboard and the infrastructure being put in by CDM today is enabling the federal government to achieve that vision of security automation.
Whether we call it FISMA compliance or CDM or whatever the technique or philosophy or approach is, ultimately the idea is not to put another procedure in place. The idea is to secure data and hardware and information. Is it your sense that CDM is the next good step to that end and that we're looking at it appropriately as a means to an end and rather than another process or another end itself?
Yeah, I would look at that in a slightly different way, Francis, in terms of recognizing it in relation to FISMA and reporting. I would say that CDM starts with good security first, with that reporting as a byproduct. So if you do it right up front and you have all of the artifacts and all of the information, the right sensors, the right automation, the right feeds coming into the Department of Homeland Security, in the end, there should be a very easy way of getting that information out in a way that enables us not only to measure current threats coming in and know which mission or which agency they will affect and be able to close those holes, but at the same time be able to report on that compliance model in a more automated fashion.
What kind of progress is the government making at getting the security that it needs built into the systems and software that it acquires rather than we're going to get this, and then, oh, by the way, we have to add the security on at the end, as we saw for many years.
Oh, yeah. We've called that building security in versus bolting it on.
Yeah.
I've represented the software security industry for many, many years now. And we have seen over the years that that some organizations, some industries, for example, the financial services, start with software security at the very beginning of their development cycles. And they check their software all throughout a development cycle, whether they build it in-house or if they outsource their software development. They will check it for vulnerabilities and they will fix everything before they put something into production. Up until recently, we did not see the federal government going in that direction because it was not part of FISMA or the current security strategy of the federal government. So, that said, over the past several years, we've seen the movement and have been working with government agencies and the Department of Defense to position software security as a must-have. Build security in versus trying to bolt it on at the end of a software development lifecycle. CDM is the first large program to do that. CDM had made an acquisition in February of this year that made it was one of the largest software security acquisitions in world history. So they took it on, understanding that software vulnerabilities are an area that hackers are using today, and they're a very, very easy way for hackers to get in and to steal large amounts of private information or credit card data. And so they've determined that they are going to try to fix that problem across the civilian government.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a sense of how agile development impacts the security of a system that somebody's developing? Does it make it easier or harder to build security in when you're doing it in small pieces like that?
You know, it doesn't. It's in terms of agile or waterfall development, any ways that the software development community is working today, there are ways to implement software security into the process. Okay, there's most organizations will look at it as either a security gating function. For example, the current government sort of certification and accreditation process where, you know, they will accept a system to go into production, but just before it goes into production, we test it for security. Mm-hmm. In my eyes, that's not the best way to do it. It should be on a developer's desktop from the very beginning. In fact, before they start development, they should consider it in the architecture and design phases of mission development. So, you know, looking at it from the beginning, make sure that you put security into it. But also, software developers really don't have any training in software security. And so part of what we viewed as HP, one of the areas that we have focused on, is helping those software developers by putting software security intelligence on their desktop while they're developing software. So right in the tools that they use, they have the guidance necessary in the language of their choice to be caught when they institute or when they write something that could be vulnerable. We will flag it. And we'll show them right at their development time, right as they're writing their software, how to fix that vulnerability so it never even makes it to that certification and accreditation process.
Rob Roy of Hewlett-Packard's my guest today. As we look at this from a human perspective, a people perspective, how much of this is a software development issue versus a procurement and requirements issue where the government is or is not effectively conveying what their security requirements are? I mean, we all know about the legislative requirements, FISMA and so on. But I imagine there are situations where the agencies want to use that as a floor rather than a ceiling of what they expect out of something.
That's a really good point. So in terms of acquisition rules, software security is not in there and has not been in there. There are references to quality, however, and I think one could put security as a quality measure. For example, if you buy something if you buy an automobile and the seatbelts aren't working, well, that's a security function, but mm-hmm. It's also a quality function. So we need to ensure that the acquisition rules and the policies for acquiring technology right now incorporate these sorts of checks. And we have seen in successful programs organizations that have stepped out and have led the way in the government who are not doing things the normal way in terms of their acquisition. They've in their contracting shops, they've actually added new guidance to their contracts that specify exactly what they'll accept, and that they specify, we're going to check your software when you give it to us, because by and large, most government software is outsourced, right? It's written by contractors. Mm-hmm. But we will check your software, and before we will accept it, we will verify that you do not have these types, and they categorize which vulnerabilities that they will not accept. Mm-hmm. Things like SQL injection or cross-site scripting. Those are egregious vulnerabilities that shouldn't be in any software. They're easy to find. They're easy to fix. So this organization has said that they will not accept those, and they've brought their defect ratio, which is that it's the common way of referencing how many vulnerabilities are in the lines of code of an application. They've brought their defect ratio down to 0%.
How common is that, though? I haven't heard of it before.
Highly uncommon, because most organizations think, oh, to get it down that low, you would actually have to spend too much money on the systems that you're acquiring. It turns out that when they force an organization to start the process earlier and put it on the developer's desktop, the developers catch themselves, and it does not add to the cost of a program.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of gets back to the question that I had before about this potentially being a mindset thing, a cultural thing, rather than a technology thing, because it sounds like what you're suggesting is that some agencies are not even thinking to ask, deciding ahead of time that it's not going to be possible. Am I hearing that right?
That's correct, yes. It hasn't been the norm because most organizations would view software and the development process as instituting something new, so having to accept some new change, and that disrupts the development process and the production process. So that is certainly a challenge, but it is more of a change management process at this point than a technology one.
How much of this is being driven by budget concerns where agencies understand that they're not going to get as many do-overs as maybe they've had in the past?
That's a great point. I think that part of what DHS did is they're actually covering this area for the civilian government. We have seen legislation on Capitol Hill directed at the Department of Defense in the National Defense Authorization Act since 2011, directing the department to do the same thing. So all of that has to come with the appropriate budget and the processes and the infrastructure to enable it.
Now, I wonder from a people perspective, what challenges you see workforce-wise, both for your people at HP and companies like you, the companies you compete against, what's available to you, and also about the customers that you serve in the government, the kinds of people they're looking for, the kinds of people that maybe they can't find, and that's why they turn to a company like yours to help support them.
Absolutely. So from a supply and demand perspective, we certainly do not see the university system today producing software developers in a way that they understand security. So there's not a lot of good software security curriculum out there that gives us prepared developers. For example, very large software companies, Microsoft, Hewlett Packard, Oracle, all the big ones. When we hire new developers right out of the university system, we often put them through several months of software development and security training before we allow them to even touch a line of code. Question is, what about those people that are going into government service right now or into the contractor community and building the mission systems of government? My last count, there were over 100,000 applications, software applications that run the business of government. It's not just what's on your desktop. It's the mission systems. It's the web systems and so forth. And so there are a lot of people that develop and maintain all of those systems, and they need the ability, they need the training and the technologies to help them be successful with software security.
Mm-hmm. What would a good program look like, or what would a good training agenda look like for somebody to come either to you or come to an agency prepared in that area? And is that something that, say, a college or university is prepared to do, or is that something that maybe is better off living within the bounds of a company because then you can train them exactly how you want them?
That's a good point. I think there's always a baseline of capability that folks are looking for. So the university system, I think, is the most appropriate. As they are developing software, there should always be part of the curriculum that says it's not good enough to just build a button that presses down and performs some function. You have to make sure that when somebody uses that, it doesn't cause some unanticipated or vulnerability in the software. So I think that there is a basis, which is what the university system typically provides, and then you learn more while you're on the job. And there is where I think, especially in things as complex as software development, there's opportunity to help them with intelligent advisors on their desktops. So to help them via the systems that they're using to instruct them. Don't just give them a blank canvas, but give them a color by numbers, if you will, that gives them the guidance to where they could be treading on vulnerable areas. and that they could then correct them while they're in that development process.
One of our top stories on federalnewsradio.com this afternoon is the naming of Megan Smith of Google as the new chief technology officer, and Alexander McGillivray, who used to be the general counsel at Twitter, as the deputy CTO. What kind of a signal do you think that sends to potential members of a workforce for either a federal agency or a company that does business with the federal government pretty extensively about the status of the government as a place to be involved in kind of cutting-edge technology?
I think that's a great point. I mean, we've heard a lot in the current administration about, you know, a focus on public service and enticing the younger generation to come into the to public service. And what I think we're seeing now is something, and I recall Ronald Reagan even saying this during his administration when he was trying to outfit his administration. He said something along the lines of, I'm not looking for people who want to come into government. I want people who want to just work for government. I want people who have a desire to change government, mm-hmm. to come in and do something that's going to propel it forward. So I think, you know, having high profile individuals like that can establish a baseline to allow others that may be considering coming into public service to say, hey, look, you know, these are visionaries. These are folks that are at some of the most profound companies that are changing the world in technology. Maybe it is good to go into public service and to jump on board.
Rob Roy of HP Enterprise Security Products, my guest. And I know you didn't come here to have an HR conversation, but these issues that we're discussing from a technology perspective increasingly become that, because if you don't have the good people, you can't serve the government customer that you have. And the government customer will also need those people to do all kinds of things that we're seeing. So it seems to me that this people element of it is kind of woven into every aspect of all of the work that you and your colleagues are doing.
People are everything. That's what it comes down to. And I think everybody in government or in the private sector, in the contractor community, recognize today that all of the technology in the world really doesn't mean anything unless there are smart people that are developing it, developing security intelligence that get embedded in it and enable those technologies to act on our behalf. After all, a machine is just doing what a person tells it to do.
We talked about the concept of security assurance and software assurance at the beginning of our conversation. What do you think that landscape looks like in the future, given the way that the threat landscape changes and evolves over time? I'm not asking you to predict particular events necessarily, although if you want to go out on a limb, go for it. But from a conceptual perspective, what would you expect to see happen in that realm over the next couple of years?
We're seeing improvements year on year right now. While the threat becomes larger because there's a lot of money at stake, as you've probably heard the quote out there, we are witnessing the largest transfer of wealth in world history. And that's due to a variety of reasons, right? We have the very, very old but stable defense in depth model. But then we had this little software layer, and we opened ourselves up to things like, you know, cloud and web services and all of that, mobile, bring your own device. So that tends to expand the footprint and the available footprint that the attackers can come in. So we do have the other side of that coin is there's a lot of investment going on in Silicon Valley and right here in the DC area in cybersecurity. So if you haven't seen recently, there are probably 3 to 5 cybersecurity conferences or shows just in the local area, just targeted towards the federal market almost every single week. In fact, HP is having our own next week. We have HP Protect right over here at the Washington Hilton next Tuesday through Thursday. And so what we'll see is with that investment and with a lot of smart people looking at cybersecurity as a challenge to be solved, we'll get ahead, but we're running behind right now. As most of the threat reports will indicate, you'll see that the attackers are advancing faster than the defenders can keep up. And with the investments and with the brains that are being brought to bear on this challenge, I do see us chipping away at and making gains in the coming years.
Is it just going to be continued application of those investments and brains, though, or do you see the potential for some kind of breakthrough, for lack of a better word, that allows the defenders to get ahead of the attackers for once.
I'd love to see that, Francis. You know, we've often talked about the silver bullet, and we see organizations that will make an impulse purchase, thinking that something, you know, by the marketing of some new capability or some new product is going to magically fix everything. And what we do see is that, you know, the attackers are like water. Every new thing that gets put in stops some initial flow, but then the attackers quickly learn ways to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
What I prefer to think of is getting back to the basics. And we find that using existing technology, but in better ways, using them more efficiently, we can look at and monitor any size organization today, figure out exactly what's going on, and shut down those attacks in real time using security intelligence.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your optimism and the water analogy. The other one that I hear is the higher wall, taller ladder thing. And there are a lot of folks that are not as optimistic as you are that we're going to be able to ever get the wall high enough that the bad guys can't build a ladder tall enough to crawl over it.
Well, we're going to have to make the bad guys better and better, and make it more and more expensive for them to do their job. Today, it's too inexpensive, and they don't need that much experience to get into our resources.